Maybe we could start this evening's proceedings. Well, welcome to you all. Good evening, and welcome to the start of this year's Miliband Public Lecture Series. I think we're now in our fourth or fifth year. It's an honor, it's a very great honor to have Zygmunt Bauman with us today and over the next few weeks. He will be delivering three lectures, which to some extent cover and summarize and bring together many aspects of his more recent work. This evening's lecture is entitled, the series is Melting Modernity, this evening's The Demons of an Open Society. Now, when reflecting on how to introduce him, an email was sent asking Zygmunt for a CV. And with characteristic modesty, he shot back, and I shall read the quote, "My CV is the hardest nut to bite. I never wrote one. Normally, I ask to introduce me as Emeritus Professor of Sociology, University of Leeds and Warsaw, and the titles of two or three books. In my view, this is quite enough. I am not the topic of the lectures I give." So, one could introduce him as follows. Zygmunt Bauman, born 1925, Potsdam, Poland, educated University of Warsaw, married to Janina in 1948, three daughters, career, 1954-68, University of Warsaw, 1968 to 1970, University of Tel Aviv, University of Leeds, 1972, 1990, retired, .. add some books. But of course, this wouldn't tell us very much about him, and I would like just to say a tiny, weeny little bit more than those bare details. He doesn't give away that much information, but in some interviews, he says something about his life, and there was one passage in a recent Guardian interview that I thought I would read, and it goes as follows. "I was brought up in a kitchen. My mother was a woman of great ambition, inventiveness, and imagination, but we were poor, and she was confined to the role of a housewife. My father came back from work in the evening and immediately fell asleep. He was exhausted. But I hold him in the very highest esteem. He was a self-made man. He never went to any schools, but he learned to read several languages and was an avid reader of wide horizons. Above all, he was amazingly honest. In fact, we almost lost our lives because of his honesty. In 1939, we were running away from Potsdam as the Germans were advancing. The town was almost on the German border. We took the last train east, but we were stopped at a station which was being bombed by the Germans. We should have run away from the station because it was the object of the bombing, but my father wanted to find a ticket inspector to pay for the trip." And I just wonder whether this has made you more or less honest in your life, Zygmunt, or sometimes strategic, because in this case, clearly honesty was an ambivalent phenomena. Born to non-practicing Jewish parents in Poland, Zygmunt Bauman escaped into the Soviet zone of occupation after Poland was invaded in 1939. He then served in the Soviet-controlled Polish military unit. After the war, he began to study sociology at the University of Warsaw, where he became a professor. In March 1968, an anti-Semitic purge saw many of Polish Jews exit from that country. This included Zygmunt Bauman. He first went to Israel to teach at the University of Tel Aviv, and then he was appointed chair of sociology at the University of Leeds, where I have discovered he was head of department for 14 years. For those of us who are academics in this room, that is a mighty, mighty sentence. Now he tells me there are six professors at the University of Leeds, none of whom are heads of department. It's obviously taken a long time to learn how to shirk off those roles. But perhaps the most extraordinary thing about Zygmunt's academic career is that after retirement, he became increasingly prolific. Perhaps now one could say, finally, free and secure, he wrote and he wrote and he wrote, and he publishes almost now a book a year. Described variously as one of the 20th century's great social theorists or one of the world's foremost sociologists of postmodernity, Zygmunt Bauman has developed a powerful, distinctive analysis of the human condition, analyzing moral dilemmas, emotional torments, social pressures, and the political choices we face in the modern world. He cites three great influences on his life: Antonio Gramsci, George Simmel, and his wife Janina. They're the big triad of influences. He perceived Gramsci's work as an antidote to the determinism of Marxism. Simmel provided aspects of method, while Janina taught him that for sociology to make sense, it must above all serve humankind. His reputation has been built on a vast number of books, which I will not list or, by any means, just a few: Legislators and Interpreters, Modernity and the Holocaust, Maternity and Ambivalence, Globalization, the Human Consequences, Liquid Modernity, Liquid Love. I won't go on. He's been awarded the most prestigious prizes in the field, the Amalfi Prize in 1990, the Adorno Prize in 1998, and his works have been translated into over 40 languages. Now, I want you to join with me to give him a very, very warm welcome, especially since this is his 80th year. So welcome to the LSE, Zygmunt Bauman. Happy birthday.
I'm afraid from now on there will be all the way down, because David held such an expectation so high that I can't possibly climb that height. But that's not my major worry at the moment. I accepted David Held's invitation for 3 consecutive David Miliband lectures as a tribute to a great thinker, passionate man, and to my very great luck, my very great friend, Ralph Miliband. And when I heard about this possibility of falling into this rubric, deliver Ralph Miliband lectures, I thought of the possibility, very difficult one, but still a real one, just make an effort to try to look at the world as it is today, the world which Ralph Miliband didn't have chance to see himself, through his eyes, through the eyes of his problems, of his passions, and his very ambitious projects about the world. I am not sure whether I am a good person to do that effort and to deliver the outcome of it to you. And I am not sure whether I will match the degree of perceptiveness, insightfulness, which was the distinctive mark of Ralph Miliband as a scholar and as a man. But I will try to do my best. Unfortunately, I won't be able to ask Ralph Miliband what is his view, whether I represented the picture of the world we live in as he would do it if he was with us. I would like to dedicate my 3 consecutive lectures roughly to 3 problems. The first one today is in what sort of a world we are living. At the moment, it will be mostly an exercise in diagnostics, but it would be a partisan diagnosis, from the perspective of my overlong age. I came to the conclusion that virtually all social scientists are partisan, but only few of them are unashamedly so. Ralph Miliband was unashamedly partisan, and so I would like to be, at least in this lecture, in his honor. The second lecture will ask the question, what sort of life we are living in this kind of a world? And the third question, the most risky one, the most difficult one probably, is what could be done? What could be done to improve the world, if that's at all thinkable, conceivable? You probably know what is the difference between optimist and pessimist. The optimist think that this world of ours is the best conceivable world, and the pessimist suspect that the optimist might be right. So from this point of view, Ralph Miliband was neither optimist nor pessimist, because he deeply believed in possibility of a different alternative world and a world better than the one in which we live. And I agree with him 100% on this point. The third question also will be asking even more difficult questions. Question, namely, if we know what could be done, who is able to do so? Are there any forces in contemporary world which would be able to tackle the task? I was thinking, ladies and gentlemen, how to start these lectures, and just to pick up from where Ralph Miliband left it. And I think that the first concept which should be heard in this series is the concept of justice. Social justice was extremely important, I think, one of the motives. As far as I can see Ralph Miliband's biography, I think that was the motivating force of his life, which gave the inner logic to, convoluted as most lives are in our convoluted times. So I would like to start from reminding you of an ancient saying, the expression of ancient wisdom, civis pacem para justitiam, which in very awkward translation into English would be something like that: if you want peace, take care of justice. Take care of justice. That's what ancient wisdom averred. And unlike knowledge, wisdom does not age. So it keeps its importance, significance of the message over ages. Absence of justice, I think, is still barring the road to peace today, as it did 2 millennia ago. What has changed, actually, since then, is that the ideal and postulates of justice and the practice of injustice, against which the ideal rebelled, were locked in a space limited by the natural ability of human perception and action, and therefore were territorially confined. Local justice, however, today is a planetary issue. I think that among various aspects of globalization, and David held it in a much better position to tell you about them, he is the mister of globalization, a person who probably knows more about it than anybody else. I suggest that among these many, many aspects of globalization, there is also a process of globalization of justice. Well, you may protest right away, because if you look around the world, it doesn't seem to be globalization of justice going on there. Of course, off cuff, I can give you some extreme examples of which show that it is not like that. If you take into account, for example, that half of global investment benefits just 22 countries in the world, which are populated by a mere 14% of world population, whereas 49 poorest countries, which are inhabited by 11% of the world population, receive between themselves but a half of 1% of the share of global product. Now, these are dimensions of global justice. Another example, Tanzania. Tanzania earns $2.2 billion a year, which it divides between 25 million of its inhabitants. The Goldman Sachs Bank earns $2.6 billion a year, which is then divided between 161 stockholders. So What I mean by globalization of justice is not that we exercise some sort of a planned, deliberate, long-term effort in bringing justice to the planet. What I mean is that the dimension in which the issue of justice could be today considered are indeed global. State of denial, of which Stanley Cohen wrote his very profound study, I think two lost their importance in our contemporary times. The formula of denial of responsibility in terms of, well, I didn't know about it, is out of question today, because very distant suffering in places, among peoples whom we never meet and never visit, are as vividly, as luridly shown in our sitting rooms as sufferings which we observe or could observe if we didn't use private cars in the street which we walk every day. So we all know the at least certain aspect dimensions of the volume of suffering in the world. At least we are able to know. We have no excuse of not knowing it. Also the second kind of denial, the second formula, formula that I am not responsible for what's happening there, what has happened to these people, is also out of the question, simply because thing which happened really to the human species in recent half a century or so is that we are all now dependent on each other. We are all dependent on each other. Whatever happens here in London has far-reaching repercussions, an enormous distance, not only distance in space, but also distance in time. What we are doing today is affecting the life of future generations, which we will never see face to face, but which I hope will still be born on planet Earth. So we are all responsible for everything which happens in the world, and whatever happens in London, whatever is planned in London, must take into account things which happen far away from here. In this sense, we are objectively, so to speak, responsible for each other. So one excuse is left, which is still very much a current excuse, and probably, unfortunately, with a long future in front of it. And that is the excuse, I can't do nothing about it. I don't have enough power. I don't have strength. I don't know where from to start. I or we, whatever is understood by the we, whatever you include in this we, are simply not up to the task. I think that that is the product of the kind of globalization which we have here, which we have so far. And that globalization I described as a negative globalization. I think we had so far purely negative globalization, which consisted in breaking boundaries, in making holes in protective walls, and opening up territories. So that space is no longer doesn't longer have a protective function to play. Space distance doesn't protect. That has been clearly the achievement of negative globalization, which was mostly globalization of trade, finance, capital, surveillance and information, coercion and weapons, crime and terrorism, life, trade of life shortening and life and lengthening stuffs, and these sort of things, but which can really today disdain virtually all territorial sovereignty and respect no state boundary. We haven't started, however, yet in earnest the development of the positive globalization, which would restore the marriage, the wedlock between power and politics, which in the result of negative globalization undergo a divorce. So, open society in the title of this lecture is not open society of Karl Popper. It is open society forcibly opened up. It is not the kind of open society which is in its original meaning given by Karl Popper stood for the self-determination of a free society, proud of its openness. Well, the idea of open society, as I use it, brings to mind mostly the terrifying experience of heterogeneous, vulnerable population overwhelmed by forces it neither controls nor truly understands, horrified by its indefensibility and obsessed with security of its borders and individuals within them. The problem is, however, that on a globalized planet, that is the assertion which I offer to your critical scrutiny, on a globalized planet, security cannot be achieved and cannot be assured in one taken apart country or in a selected group of countries, not by their own means and not independently of the rest of the world. That's what is meant by globalization of the issue of justice, not so much of justice, but of issue of justice. So far, we have achieved only the negative unity of mankind. Hannah Arendt had a description of it. She said that what we achieved is that we are afraid of each other, that we treat each other as threats, mutual threats, or Milan Kundera, my beloved exile Czech writer, put it this way, that globalization means that there is nowhere to escape. Ladies and gentlemen, the problem is that if we want to consider the issue of justice in contemporary conditions, we need to take into account the global space. The openness in terms which I just used in a moment to describe it of societies is in itself a prime cause of injustice, and so obliquely also of conflict and violence, which is also becoming global. As Arundhati Roy puts it, while the elite pursue their voyages to their imaginary destination, some place at the top of the world, the poor have been caught into a spiral of crime and chaos. It is the action of the United States, together with its various satellites, like the World Bank, World Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, that, I quote from Arundhati Roy, prompted subsidiary developments, dangerous subproducts such as nationalism, religious fanaticism, fascism, and of course terrorism, advancing, marching step in step with the neoliberal ideals and the practices. Well, these are the existential tremors, I think, which lie somewhere beneath, which provide the ground for the contemporary fears. I'm not suggesting to you that being afraid is a novelty of our liquid modern times. It is as old, at least, a condition as mankind was. It's hardly to think of any kind of society in which it was not a marked feature of very, very, very many people. However, the existential travels which characterize our own times differ from their predecessors by the fact that perhaps for the first time they provide a possibility of decoupling the fear-inspired actions from the existential travels from themselves, which generate the fear that inspired them. It's a sort of displacement of fear, which makes contemporary fears, in a sense, free-floating, unattached, unanchored, ready to be commercially capitalized on and also politically capitalized on. Handling the sources of this fear, cutting at the source of the fear, is not on the cards at the moment. It's a distant prospect, but not a prospect of immediate future, simply because of what I would like to call a tools crisis. Inadequacy between tools of effective action, which we dispose of, which are at hand, which we can use, and the enormity of the task which there is. We don't have any global equivalent of the institutions which were developed throughout modern times to handle this issue of social justice at the level of the nation state. That was the highest level in which these tools achieved. We have no equivalent of such tools, no representative kind of democracy, equivalent of representative democracy, no effective executive powers, and obviously no effective global juridical system which would be able perhaps to be addressed as the proper tool, as the proper instrument of changing the present, not very prepossessing state of justice. Ladies and gentlemen, several years before the 11th September, before tsunami, before Katrina, and the terrifying leap in petrol prices, which followed immediately these natural catastrophes. Before these all events, which we still keep in our memory, supplied occasions to wake up and sober up, a very perceptive analyst of contemporary culture, Frenchman Jacques Attali, pondered the phenomenal financial triumph of the film Titanic. I wonder whether you still remember this film. It was talk of the town a few years ago, but human memory is shortening. The span of human memory is shortening on a lightning speed, and our contemporary culture is more culture of forgetting than culture of learning, as I was told half a century ago when I was a student of sociology. But if you remember, please recall as well that Titanic broke the box office record at that time, and Jacques Attali provided analysis of hypotheses why it so happened. In a statement which at that time, when I read it first time, seemed to be provocative, but now looking back I see it as prophetic. So what he said was the following: Titanic is us, our triumphalist, self-congratulating, blind, hypocritical society, merciless towards its poor, a society in which everything is predicted except the means of predicting. We all guess that there is an iceberg waiting for us, hidden somewhere in the misty future, which we will hit and then go down to the sounds of music. Now, both things are important. The iceberg, hidden iceberg, invisible iceberg. But we sense that there might be an iceberg because in these areas there are icebergs time and again. And this sweet music, sounds of music, sweet music, as it were, soothing exhilarating live music, real-time music, latest hits, top celebrity performers, reverberating beats that deafen, blinkering stroboscopic lights that blind, making the faint whispers of forebodings inaudible and the enormity of majestically silent icebergs invisible. To go back to Jacques Attali named several icebergs. He named financial iceberg, nuclear iceberg, ecological iceberg, demographic icebergs. Were he writing today in 2005, I suspect he would throw in several other icebergs which are somewhere waiting in the dark. He would mention probably terrorist iceberg. He would mention religious fundamentalism iceberg. And I think, who knows, he would probably mention as well the implosion or collapse of civilization iceberg. Phenomenon which could be recently watched in the aftermath of Middle Eastern military adventures or Katrina's visit to New Orleans in a sort of dress rehearsal and in all its ugly, gruesome monstrosity. Just to read you one fragment of one bit of information, how it looked like when civilization collapses. The report from New York Times from New Orleans, a few weeks after Katrina struck. In the downtown business district here on a dry stretch of Union Street, a corpse. New Orleans, September 2005. Hours passed. The dusk of curfew crept. The body remained. Night came, then this morning, then noon, another sun beat down on a dead sun of the Crescent City. What is remarkable is that on a downtown street in a major American city, a corpse can decompose for days like carrion, and that is acceptable. Welcome to New Orleans in the post-apocalypse. Scraggly residents emerge from waterlogged wood to say strange things and then return into the rot. Cars drive the wrong way on the interstate and no one cares. Fires burn, docks scavenge, and old signs from Le Bon Temps have been replaced with hand-scrawled threats that looters will be shot dead. The incomprehensible has become routine. As Jean-Pierre Dupuy recently said in the little metaphysic of tsunami, what we suddenly begin to understand today is that what is probably likely to be happening over and over again is what he calls the eruption of the possible inside the impossible. And he warned, to prevent a catastrophe, one needs first to believe in its possibility. The most sinister aspect of threatening catastrophes is the disbelief that they are possible to happen. The present situation shows us, observes Dupuy, that the announcement of a catastrophe does not make any visible change, neither in our manner of conduct nor in our way of thinking. Even when they have been informed, people don't believe what they learned. Another French sociologist, Corinne Lepage, points out the mind rejects such announcement, telling itself that it is just not possible. The most awesome obstacle to the prevention of a catastrophe is its incredibility. Well, the apocalypse now, that very expression I think is a challenge to our idea of probability, Well, the apocalypse now has been staged again. But this time not in a film theater or in the theater of imagination, but on the downtown streets of a major American city. Dan Barry, correspondent of New York Times, points out it didn't happen in Baghdad, not in Rwanda, it happened here. Well, I would like to add to that, that this apocalypse didn't happen this time in faraway Vietnam rainforest, as the creators of the film under this title thought they should be placed, nor in the dark shores of the darkest of continents where Conrad placed the Heart of Darkness to make his message legible to the civilized readers. It happened here in the heart of the civilized world, in a city acclaimed for its beauty and its joie de vivre, and until a few days ago, playing a magnet for millions of tourists circling the globe in search of the high art, refined delights, and high-class entertainment. Timothy Garton Ash recently probably said, saw it, it was in The Guardian, in an essay under Telling It All title, It Always Lies Below, vividly put it, the crust of civilization betrayed is always wafer thin. One tremor and you have fallen through, scratching and gouging for your life like a wild dog. And he continues, I can't avoid the feeling that there will be more of this, much more of it, and as we go deeper into the 21st century. There are just too many big problems looming which could push humanity back. If large parts of the world were tormented by unpredictable storms, flooding, and temperature changes, then what happened in New Orleans would seem like a tea party. In a sense, these too would be man-made hurricanes. For example, the consequences of the United States continuing to pump out carbon dioxide as if there were no tomorrow. But there are also more direct threats of humans towards other humans. Suppose there is a dirty bomb or even a small nuclear weapon exploded by a terrorist group in a major city. What then? Well, rhetorical question, to be sure. Ash's message is that the threat of de-civilization, very interesting, fascinating concept which he gleaned in one of Jack London's novels, de-civilization is frightfully real. Remove the elementary staples of organized civilized life, food, shelter, drinkable water, minimal personal safety, and we go back within hours to a Hobbesian state of nature, a war of all against war. Well, I would like to call it what the phenomena which I try to describe using profusely people wiser than myself opinions. I would like to call it Titanic complex or Titanic syndrome. And I think that it has two aspects, Titanic syndrome. Titanic syndrome, to start with, is the horror of falling through this wafer-thin crust of civilization into that nothingness, stripped of the elementary staples of organized civilized life. Falling in a company, falling together with others. Whether it is a fear of natural catastrophe or whether it's a fear of man-made disaster is a very tricky question, very complex to answer, really. Remember the Titanic adventure. In Titanic adventure, the principal actor of the story was the iceberg made of ice, a mountain of ice somewhere in Arctic waters. But the horror of the story was not the iceberg itself. The iceberg functioned only as a sort of a litmus paper or a catalyst, chemical catalyst. But the real to let off the horror which followed. But the horror, the real horror, was what happened after meeting the iceberg in the waters, when it became, for example, apparent that there are no workable plans to evacuate and salvage the passengers of a sinking ship, or that there is an acute shortage of lifeboats and lifebelts. Very similar things which were discovered suddenly, abruptly, to horror of its inhabitants in New Orleans. So that's one thing. Catastrophe falling on us all, the staples of civilization breaking apart. Everyone will be caught unprepared and defenseless. But there is another aspect of Titanic syndrome, and that is the fear of being picked up from the Jewish crowd, singly or severally at the utmost, and condemned to suffer alone while revelries of the rest go on. In other words, fears of a personal catastrophe, individual catastrophe. Fears of becoming a selected target, earmarked for personal doom. Fears of falling out or being thrown over the board of the fast accelerating vehicle, while the rest of humanity, the rest of the riders, with their seatbelts securely buckled, find the travel ever more entertaining. In other words, fears of being left behind, fears of exclusion. And now following Jack Attali's line, I will try to analyze very briefly the secret of the tremendous success of television reality shows like Big Brother and The Weakest Link, because that explanation here is very similar to what Jack Attali make clear in case of the phenomenal success of the Titanic film. Well, reality TV, the word, have you ever thought about it? No one objects against the title, reality TV, reality TV show. It means two things. Well, the obvious meaning of the phrase reality TV is that what you see here is for real. There was no scenario, there was no prescripted action. It is actually taking place. But the other meaning of it, and much more pernicious and much more sinister in its consequences, is that what you see here is reality. Well, that is reality, what you see here. And what the reality is, you probably watched as most of citizens of this country and 35 other countries around the world, you probably watched Big Brother time and again, and you watched particularly The Weakest Link, which bears the message of Big Brother to the bare bones, in a sense, strips it to the bare bones. The reality as shown on this reality TV shows is that life is mostly about who will exclude whom. Exclusion itself is not under discussion because there's a rule, iron rule, which can't be broken, that every week one person must be excluded. And for those impatient who can't wait the full week, there is The Weakest Link, where somebody must be excluded every 5 minutes. But somebody must be excluded. And the whole secret here is whether you are clever enough to exclude the others before they exclude you. Now, that is the second aspect of Titanic syndrome, fear of exclusion, fear of individual catastrophe, personal catastrophe. which is all the more painful for the fact that it strikes only one single person of an utmost a very small group of persons. Well, you read quite a lot. It is a very popular concept today in sociology. We undergo a process of individualization. As Ulrich Beck famously put it, we as individuals are expected to find individual solutions operable by individually possessed means to resolve socially produced problems. Now, the kind of processes which go on in our society on the global scale, particularly the tendencies of most of the government to contract out the social to the highest bidder and to renounce quite a number of functions, among other very important functions, the function of the collective insurance, communal insurance, against individual mishaps, individual misfortune. Now, this task falls upon individuals. And the very dangerous aspect of this falling upon individuals is that it erodes the solidarity of the weak. The fears, which I briefly mentioned here, are of such a nature that they don't add up. They are not ground for solidarity. Everybody is left with the problems created by this Individual Exclusion Act alone. It's striking how most of the governments, without saying it in so many words, follows the Margaret Thatcher sociology. I hope you still remember it. It should be forgotten, but then we are reminded daily of its substance, namely that there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals and their families. Now, it is very interesting to study the political language of today, how seldom the idea of social appears there. How much appeal is made to individual resources and individual initiatives. But the result, as I repeat, is the disruption of the ground on which human solidarity was created. Human solidarity is presumably, you probably agree with that, one of the central factors of social integration, or condition of social integration. Under such circumstances, when there is a withdrawal from the social and subsidiarizing, as if, of social problems to the individual initiative, there is a need, a high demand, in alternative legitimation of state authority, which once was based precisely or was evolving towards social state based on the principle of the collective responsibility for individual fortune, individual well-being, individual ability to survive and to live dignified life, and so on and so on. Now, once that legitimation is very seldom and ever more seldom invoked, that there must be alternative legitimation of state authority, and with the rather bad press which the idea of the social has in the contemporary political language, it can't be any longer, of course, the legitimation through the idea of social security. Instead, what is called the increasing responsibility, increasing visibility of state concern with security is in fact switching of the idea of security towards the pole of safety. It is more about personal safety. The specter of social degradation, against which the social state swore to ensure its citizens, is being gradually and consistently replaced by the threat of a pedophile let loose, of a serial killer, obtrusive beggar, mugger, stalker, prowler, poisoner, terrorist, or better yet, by all such threats rolled into one, into the figure of an illegal immigrant. Well, so where does it leave the individuals? Where does it leave us as individuals? Unable to slow down the mind-boggling pace of change, let alone to predict and determine its direction, we focus on things which we can or believe we can or are assured that we can influence. We try to calculate, for example, and minimize the risks of falling victims of all sorts of uncountable dangers which we suspect the opaque world and its uncertain future holds in store for us as individuals. We are engrossed, for example, many of us are anyway, in spying out the seven signs of cancer or the five symptoms of depression, not economic depression, mind you, but psychological depression, or in exercising the specter of high blood pressure and high cholesterol level, stress or obesity. In other words, we seek substitute targets on which to unload the surplus existential fear that has been barred its natural outlet, and find such makeshift targets in taking elaborate precaution against, for instance, inhaling someone else's cigarette smoke, ingesting fatty food, or God forbid, bad bacteria, as different from good bacteria, which we are advised to consume in a lot, in huge quantities, exposure to sun, or exposure to unprotected sex. Those of us who can afford it fortify ourselves against the visible or invisible, present or anticipated, known or yet unfamiliar, scattered but ubiquitous dangers. In what way? Through detoxicating interiors of our bodies and homes, locking ourselves behind walls, stuffing the approaches to our living quarters with TV cameras, hiring armed guards, driving armored vehicles, or taking martial arts classes. And if we really can afford it, we are buying ourselves into a gated community where the strangers are barred entry. Well, it is all consequence of the gap, hiatus, discrepancy, mutual inadequacy between means of action which we have and the means of collective action, as you probably could gather from what I said so far, are becoming more and more scarce and more inefficient. Now, means of action on the one hand and the enormity, globality of task which stands in front of us. Having leaked from the society forcefully laid open by the pressure of globalizing forces, power and politics drift ever further in opposite directions. The modern times long wedlock between power and politics ended up, as so many other marriages, in divorce. We have on the one hand power without politics, power politically uncontrolled. On the other hand, we have politics with less and less power, drifting in separate directions. And I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the 21st century we just started, probably will confront as its paramount challenge the imperative to bring power and politics together again. the reunion of the separated partners inside their so far domicile of nation state is perhaps the least promising of the possible responses to that challenge. On a negatively globalized planet, all the most fundamental problems, the meta problems, conditioning the tackling of all other problems, are global. And being global, they admit of no local solutions. They are not and cannot be local solutions to globally originated and globally invigorated problems. The reunion of power and politics may be achieved, if at all, on the planetary level. As Benjamin Barber poignantly put it recently, no American child may feel safe in its bed if in Karachi or Baghdad children won't feel safe in theirs. Europeans won't boast long of their freedoms if people in other parts of the world remain deprived and humiliated. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the longer democracy and freedom may be assured in one country, or even in a group of countries, their defense in a world saturated with injustice and inhabited by billions of humans denied human dignity would inevitably corrupt the very values they are meant to defend. The future of democracy and freedom may be made secure on a planetary scale or not at all. Fear is arguably the most sinister of demons nesting in the open societies of our time. But it is the insecurity of the present and uncertainty about the future that hatch and breed the most awesome and least bearable of our fears. Those insecurity and uncertainty, in their turn, are born of the sense of impotence. We seem to be no longer in control. That's how it feels. We are not in control, whether singly, severally, or even collectively. To make things worse yet, we lack the tools that could allow politics to be lifted to the level where power has already settled, and so enable us to recover and repossess control over the forces that shape our shared condition while setting the range of our options and the limits of our freedom to choose. Control which has now slipped or has been torn, or so it seems at least, out of our hands. The demon of fear won't be exorcised until we find, or more precisely, construct such tools. Thank you.
I have rarely heard this lecture theatre so quiet, and I rarely sat here and seen no one leave. So that is a mark, I think, of the awe with which we have consumed and are challenged by your lecture. When I announced that Zygmunt was coming to the LSE to give this series of lectures, I was struck also by several students coming up to me and saying things like, "I'm so glad he's coming. I love his books." Or, "I was deeply moved by his last book." Or, "No book before has challenged me to think of sociology in this particular way," and so on. And I can think of none of my colleagues' books, or even my own books, that have ever enjoyed such a reception. And I think this evening's lecture is an illustration of why Zygmunt Bauman's work touches something of great importance and of great profundity, is expressed in extraordinary elegance, even if you may have reservations about some aspects of the arguments. Well, now is your opportunity to express some of those reservations in the form of short questions. Two nota benes, really, two points. Could you keep your questions fairly short, and could you ensure that you speak very clearly in order for Zygmunt to grasp the points you want to make? And there should be roaming mics. Are there roaming mics? Yep, And so make sure no question is asked without a mic, slowly, loudly, clearly, briefly. Right, we usually take questions in clusters of five in these lectures, just to give you a chance to get some points out. So let me start with whoever wishes to speak first. Gentleman over there.
Yes, I won't hear anyway, so you
will
tell me. This is on, yeah? Okay. Hi, I'm a second-year student in geography with economics. My name's Adrian Basiri. Modern society, in your opinion, has modern society not allowed itself and individuals to express themselves clearly and allowed themselves to be expressed outwardly? And has this type of repression, in your opinion, has it resulted in other negative outlets of being not allowed to express your opinion in society, or will it in the future, perhaps?
Modern society expresses itself?
Sorry. It's a question really about the extent to which modern society has repressed the possibility of human self-expression and political engagement, and what you think the consequences of that repression are, and perhaps entailed by the question of what you think, I guess that's the topic of other lectures, what you think it might be done to undo it. Second question, please.
Hi, I'm Olivier Charnoz. I'm a PhD student in international relations, and I really enjoy your lecture. Thank you very much.
You'll have to speak louder than that.
Okay, here's my question. As I understand it, your concept of positive globalization is somewhat like a global governance project led by liberal values, liberal ethics based on human dignity, etc. So my question is, do you really think that liberalism, in this sense, liberal ethics, is a natural and unique philosophy, workable philosophy for the regulation of globalization? Thank you.
Did you get that, yeah? In short, are you a liberal? And are those values... And are those values universalizable, and can those values be the basis of a positive globalization? You didn't quite put it that way, but you think that's a reasonable summary. Thank you very much. Okay.
Yes.
Third leg.
You want to collect all the questions?
Yes, we'll just get two or three more, just so the audience has a chance to raise a few points.
Yeah.
Anyone down here? Anyone else down here? Coming back.
Sorry for sitting. My name is Serfin Floria, and I'm studying business law and international business. And I have a question
for
Professor Bauman.
Yeah, we assume that. But you need to be clearer and louder.
Okay.
Loud. Shout.
My question is, Professor Bauman, can you please enumerate the tools that will bring in control, democracy, and freedom in a positively globalizing way?
Okay, so basically, as a liberal, if you are, what tools are the tools for your positive conception of globalization? And how can democracy and justice be re-articulated on this grander spatial scale? Thank you. That was a thank you to me.
I'm interested to know what you think the role of environmental movements and green politics can be in restoring that the unity of politics and power.
So that's the role of environmentalism, the green movement, and ecological movements. What role do they have in restoring some balance between our institutions and markets, etc.? One final point. Yeah.
I just wanted to question your statement earlier that this government shares Margaret Thatcher's sociology of only conceiving of individuals and families, because it so happens that we now actually have a minister for communities who is also Miliband. And I was just wondering, what do you make of this government's favoritism for the concept of community, and how that happens to replace the concept of society in contemporary political discourse?
Okay, well, that's five questions. So, Zygmunt, do you want to have a go at some of those?
Yes, I'm tired of having a go.
Well, it's almost each question. It was a $64,000 question, really, so I'm not sure whether I will satisfy your curiosity. I would like you to give me the answers to these questions. I would be very grateful, really. About the suppression of possibility of self-expression, it is the question mostly to be what is to be self-expressed. We have a very complex situation to which we were unprepared. Unprepared in 1755, there was an earthquake in Lisbon, and which was followed by fire which destroyed the city, and then there was a high tide, some sort of a tsunami, mini tsunami, which finished it off, what was left after two first catastrophes. And that was allegedly, according to some students, the beginning of enlightenment, beginning of modern mind, beginning of the idea that one needs to conquer the nature and to bring it to senses and to make it motivated, make it purposeful. Because clearly what's happened in Lisbon not only came unexpected, but struck at random, hitting the guilty ones and the virtuous ones alike, and not making any choices, and so on and so on. It was hoped at the beginning, very beginning of modernity, that slowly when we developed, when we get more science, more technology, more scientifically inspired organization of society and human cooperation, we will have nature tamed. It would be more like human action. Human action, which Alfred Schütz, following Max Weber, memorably described as being conducted not because of, but in order to. Now, it proved to be all this great effort done in 200-odd years, just a big detour. And at the end of the detour, we have returned, in a sense, to the starting point. Namely, it is not so much that nature becomes more tamed, civilized, like human actions were hoped to become, but the product, the outcomes of human action strike us more and more as natural disasters. They are the same way unexpected, unpredictable, and they strike at random without much selecting their targets. Now, that is the nature of the present situation. So what is to be self-expressed here? The risks of which were made so famous by Ulrich Beck, already mentioned on this evening, are different from other known dangers in history, in the sense that they are not visible but naked eye. If there was a clear-cut connection between, say, hunger and famine on the one hand, and food and necessity to produce food and get food on the other, it is not instantly clear what is to be done in case of the dangers of our own present day. And besides, because these dangers are not immediately visible, they are not given in our own daily experience, we don't know them from point blank, we don't confront them point blank. They must be first explained to us that there is such a danger. You mentioned about green movement. Now, green movement tries very, very hard for many decades already to convince people that there is a danger growing to the very possibility of humanity continuing its life on this planet. This planet may become unlivable. But it is speaking, you may believe it or you may reject it. As Jean-Pierre Dupuy suggests, most of us do reject it because the risk is not given in our direct experience. On the other hand, the same feature of risks, they are not visible, they are not given in daily experience, enables also ill-intentioned people of all sorts to argue the non-existing risks or exaggerated risks into human consciousness, into human knowledge of the world. So in both ways, we are from both sides, we see that we are moving here on a very slushy ground. And the question, how to enable, restore, reconstruct, recreate this ability of self-expression is very closely related to the other questions we were asked here, namely, the purposes which we, some of us in some parts of the planet pursue, is it possible to universalize them and to spread to the whole of planet? Universality and universalization was a very important concept in the whole history of modern thinking. However, we don't have very many signs for that, that values were accepted and pursued and promoted with the idea of their universalizability, with the intention of making them truly universal. For example, the standard of living, the way of life, which we all live in Europe and its overseas extensions, if the rest of humanity were to copy, to imitate, to emulate this standard of living, this kind of living, one planet, according to all computations, won't be enough. We would need three planets to meet these needs. This globe is not able to sustain the amount of carbon dioxide which is emitted daily in the United States by their model of modernization. But, ladies and gentlemen, now we face a multiplication of that by the new policy of fast modernization in China, in India, in Brazil, and so on. Clearly, certain aspects of the mode of life which we now enjoy are not amenable to universalization. So the question is not so much, I think, of universalization of values. The question is really of negotiating the art of living on the planet together in peace, life which would require compromises, sacrifices probably, not on one side, but on many sides, until such a modus vivendi is being reached. Whether our instruments of democracy are amenable to universalization. Another question, very closely related to it. Again, there are doubts, and very serious doubts. I was present at a discussion in which Johann Galtung, who is much better political scientist than I am, he is not just writing books about politics, but he's doing politics, which I am not, working, practicing politics at the highest possible global levels. He was asked very much the same questions, and even in more specific form, how to go about arriving at a global parliament. And so Galtung said, global parliament, well, all right, so let's imagine that we have global parliament. He is himself Norwegian, so he started from Norway. He said there will be three Norwegians sitting, there will be 30 Italians, there will be 60 Germans, there will be 1,000 Indians, there will be 2,000 Chinese, And he stopped and he looked around and said, well, I don't see much enthusiasm for World Parliament. So one thing is clear, you know, that we will, I hope, I very firmly believe in it actually, that we will sooner or later we end up with some sort of a global equivalent of the institutions of democratic self-assertion, democratic self-expression, democratic representation, democratic control, but that what we will have there at the global level will be as non-reminiscent of what is going on in Westminster today, in the House of Commons or in the House of Lords, all these institutions which were developed by our ancestors during the modern era, as dissimilar from that, as what is going on in Westminster is dissimilar from what Aristotle described when he spoke, when he wrote about democracy, what he had in mind, you know, the agora in Athens, where people came together, you know, and voted the policy which they wanted to become a law. So they would be different. It would be different. It would be equivalent. Not, you know, I have personally the suspicion that the institutions, democratic institutions which we developed in the framework of nation state are not balloons which you can blow bigger and bigger and bigger. They are made to the measure of the institution of the nation state. They are not fit for being expanded in such a way. And here comes the problem. And that's the difficulty, really, ladies and gentlemen. That's the difficulty. We need not international institutions, but global institutions. There's a big difference between the two ideas. International courts of law, which we have for judging and putting into jail specific criminals, but not the others. Now, these institutions remind you of traffic rules, for example, in London, which would say that on red light, drivers must stop if they signed the convention. But if they didn't, they can, of course, can go on. Now, that's the shape of international law. What I mean by global law is something which is as binding on the territory of the planet as the British law is binding on the territory of British Isles. So binding for everybody, you know, the really global law. Now we are very far from there, and we are starting the way toward that from very unprepossessing point, namely from the world divided into territorial sovereignties, territorial nation states, and United Nations, which was created 60 odd years ago, with the briefing to defend unencroachable, inviolable sovereignty, territorial sovereignty of every state power. So how to start from here to some sort of institution which you have to undermine quite a lot of all of that. Reminds me that of the famous Irish joke, which you probably know, a driver stops a car and asks a passerby how to go to Dublin. And the answer is, oh, if I were going to Dublin, I wouldn't start from here. But unfortunately, that's the only point where we can start. There's no other point. And that makes the problem tremendously, tremendously difficult. What tools will be eventually invented to do so? I have no idea. I normally feel very ill at ease when people ask me to predict the future. I don't have any skills for prophecy. I don't believe that sociology gives us any entitlement whatsoever to predict the future. When I was younger and I still joked with my students when they were very depressed before exams, just to make them happier and smile, I gave them futurologists' predictions 20 or 30 years old, and then they laughed. So we don't have skills. Let's admit it. We can explain everything which already happened. That's what we are very good of in, really. But not necessarily deduce from what is going to happen. So I have no idea what the tools will be, but I think that they will keep surprising us. Reinhard Kozelek, with whom I discussed this matter a few years ago, he's a brilliant historian of concepts, historian of ideas, understood as history of concepts. And the question which we discussed was what degree of responsibility of French les philosophes, French philosophers of Enlightenment and French Revolution. And I said very, I gave a banal answer, of course, and obvious answer that they couldn't be held responsible because they didn't know what would happen there. But I thought Kozelek went further, and he said, and he was right, that not only they couldn't predict, they couldn't even express the what will happen later, because they lacked the concept. There was no concept of representative democracy, universal suffrage, you know, electoral laws, you know, this sort of thing. All these elementary things which became part and parcel of European history after the French Revolution created concepts which enabled their description in the course of action, not before. So I'm very sorry, I have to apologize, I can't answer this question, what tools will be good. I only think that we shouldn't stop for a moment and try to invent an experiment with tools on a very high speed, really, because delays are costly in terms of human suffering. That's the price which is being paid. There is a fashionable concept now coined, I think, during the war in Afghanistan, or was it only in Iraq, collateral casualties. Now, humanity is collateral casualty of our slowness here in this respect. Thank you.
Well, this is not the end of the show. There are two more lectures to come. I hope you will all come back. The next one, I believe, Kirsten, is next Thursday, and then another one 10 days after that. So this is just the first installment, and on this basis, I'd just like to thank you for that. Thank you. Thank you.